The poor sick nun invited Felice to take an unlikely anatomical excursion. They went on following the shore, but still trending northward. After an hour had passed, Claude said, "I'm free. How about you, Amarie?" The rider beside him was incongruously garbed in a starship captain's coverall and a wide-brimmed black hat with dark plumes. "My chains are broken. What an incredible child Felice is. But I can understand why she was ostracized by the other ring hockey players. It's too freakish, all that strength in such a doll-like body."
"Her physical strength is something the others could live with," Claude said, leaving it at that. Presently, Amarie asked,
"How many people did she set free?"
"The two Japanese riding behind her, Basil, the fellow in the Tyrolean hat, and that poor medievalist knight, Dougal, just ahead of Basil. Dougal doesn't know that his chains have been weakened enough to be broken. Felice didn't think he was stable enough to let in on the scheme. But when the thing starts, we might get him to break loose and help. Lord knows he's big and strong-looking, and maybe he hates the pawn enough to snap out of his funk when he sees others in action."
"I hope Richard will be all right."
"Don't worry. I think he's ready to do his part, if only to show Felice that she's not the only one with balls."
The nun laughed.
"What a collection we are. Exiles and losers all. We just got what we deserved, running away from our responsibilities. Look at me. A lot of people needed my ministry, but I had to brood and maunder about my own precious spirituality instead of getting on with my job. You know, Claude, most of last night was hell for me. There's something about riding that hits me in the worst way, and while I was hurting, I found I was shrinking myself. I think I finally understand the reasons why I got into this mess. Not just coming to exile. The whole thing."
The old man said nothing.
"I think you figured it out too, Claude. Quite a while ago."
"Well, yes," he admitted. "When we talked about your childhood that day on the mountain. But you had to find it out for yourself," she said softly.
"The firstborn daughter with the little mama thing in the warm Italianate family. The hard-working professional parents depending on her to help raise the cute little brothers. She loving to do it, power-tripping on the responsibility. Then the family gets ready to emigrate to a new world. Exciting! But the daughter screws up by straining some muscles and then breaking her leg in a fall. But just one short week in the tank, dear, and you can come out to us on the next ship. Hurry and get well, Anna Maria. We're going to need your help more than ever on Multnomah, big girl." "And you hurried, but by the time you were well, they were all dead. Killed in a translational malfunction of their starship, so what could you do but atone? Try through all the years to show them you were sorry that you had not died along with them. Dedicate yourself to easing the passing of others as you were not able to ease theirs." "But fighting it at the same time, Claude. I realize that now. I wasn't really a morbid person, and I was glad to be alive and not dead. But that old guilt never let me go, even though it was so well sublimated in my vocation that I didn't realize how it was undermining me. I went along for years doing work that was very hard, and refusing to take holidays or sabbaticals the way the others did. There was always a case that needed my special help, and I was always strong enough to give it. But in the end, it all became a sham. The demons weren't exercised anymore. The emotional fatigue of the job and the buried guilt all mingled and became unbearable." The old man's voice was compassionate.
"So when the contemplative orders justifiably turned you down, you scratched around and found what looked like an even better form of atonement. Can't you see that you haven't loved yourself enough, Amarie? This hermitage in exile idea was the ultimate chair in a corner facing the wall."
Her head was averted from him, so that the broad-brimmed hat hid her face. She said, "So the exile anchoress turns out to be just as much of a fraud as the ministering nun in the hospice for the dying."
"That last bit isn't true," Claude snapped. "Jen didn't think so, and neither do I, and neither do the hundreds of other suffering people you helped. For God's sake, Amory, try to keep a perspective. Every human being has deep motives as well as superficial ones. But the motivation doesn't invalidate the objective good we do."
"You want me to get on with my life and quit picking scabs. But Claude, I can't go back now, even though I know the choice was wrong. I have nothing left."
"If you've got any faith remaining at all, why not believe that you're here for a reason?"
She gave him a crooked smile. "It's an interesting idea. Suppose I spend the rest of the night meditating on it."
"Good girl. I have a feeling you won't have much time for meditation later on if Felice's plan works out. I tell you what, you meditate and I'll snooze and we'll both do ourselves good. Wake me as soon as Basil starts playing the signal. It'll be just before dawn."
"When it's darkest," sighed the nun. "Go to sleep, Claude. Pleasant dreams." There were no more double beacons, which seemed to have been the scouting party's warning of Firvalag in the vicinity. The caravan had come down from the plateau now and traversed open wooded slopes, cut by little brooks that foamed whitely over boulders, calling for a tricky footwork by the Chalicos as they picked their way along in the starshine. The country became rougher, and there was a tang of conifer resin in the air. As the night wore on, a breeze sprang up, ruffling the lake and making the beacon fires near the shore lean and twist. It was very quiet. Aside from the noise of the moving caravan, only owl hoots were to be heard. There were no lights of villages or farms, no sign of habitation at all. So much the better if they did manage to escape. They came to a deep gorge lit on both sides by bonfires, where a lonely guard post secured a suspension bridge over a cascading stream. Three torch-bearing men in bronze armor stood at attention as Epone and Captain Valdemar crossed the swaying structure. Then the soldiers led small groups of prisoners over, bracketed by amphibians. When they resumed their march, Richard told Felice,
"It's after 4. We've been losing time fording the creeks."
"We'll have to wait until we get far enough away from that damn guard post. I hadn't planned on that. There are more than 3 soldiers manning it. Count on that. Epone will be able to send them a telepathic call for help, and we've got to be sure that they'll get to us too late. I want to wait another 30 minutes at least."
"Don't cut it too fine, sweets. What if there's another post? And what about the scouts ahead who light the beacons?"
"Oh, shut up. I'm juggling factors until I'm dizzy trying to optimize this thing. Just be sure you're ready. Did you lash it firmly to your lower arm?"
"Just like you said," Felice called out.
"Basil?"
"Righto."
"Would you play some lullaby tunes for a while?"
The notes of the woodwind rose softly, soothing the riders after the brief anxiety caused by the bridge crossing. The double file of Chalicos and their flanking bear dogs now moved among titanic black conifer trunks. The trail was soft with millennia of needle duff, muffling their passage and sending even the most uncomfortable riders into a doze. The track rose gradually until it was more than 100 meters above the Lac de Bresse, with occasional sheer drops to the water on the caravan's right. Too soon, it seemed to Felice, the eastern sky began to lighten. She sighed and pulled down her hoplite helmet, then leaned forward in the saddle.
"Basil, now!"
The alpine climber played All Through the Night. When he finished it and began again, 4 amphibians went charging soundlessly to the head of the procession and hamstrung Epone's Chalico with simultaneous slashes of their teeth. The exotic woman's mount uttered a heart-stopping shriek as it went down in a welter of dark bodies. The bear dogs, with barking roars, leaped upon Epone herself,
Soldiers and the front ranks of prisoners gave shouts of horror, but the Tanu slave mistress did not cry out. Richard thumped his free feet against his mount's neck and held tightly to the reins as the creature took off. He galloped into the midst of the quartet of soldiers trying to come to the assistance of Ippon. Valdemar was shouting, "Use your lances, not the bows! Lift them off, or you stupid bastards!" Richard's Chalico reared and crashed down upon the captal, knocking him from the saddle. A figure in white robes and black veil leapt down as if to help the fallen officer. In the moment that Valdemar took to gasp astonishment at seeing a mustache on a nun's face, Richard slipped Felice's little dirk from its golden scabbard and pressed the steel blade home twice below the two corners of Valdemar's jaw, just above the gray metal necklet. His carotid arteries severed, the captal clutched at the false nun with a bubbling cry, gave a peculiar smile, and died. Two riderless Chalicos were thrashing together in the semi-darkness, inflicting ghastly wounds upon one another with their huge claws. Replacing the dirk in its sheath on his forearm, Richard seized the dead officer's bronze sword and backed off, cursing. There were confused shouts and a long scream of pain from the tangle of amphibians and armed men. The two soldiers of the rearguard came pounding up to assist their comrades. One of the men charged with lance couched, spitting a small bear dog that dashed in from the side and hoisting it high into the air. Then another hulking form came darting among the mounted guards, snapping at the heels of the enraged, screeching Chalicos. Felice sat at her beast, motionless, as though she were merely a spectator to the carnage. One of the Ronin, heels drumming the shoulders of his mount, rushed into the free-for-all and hauled back on his reins. The Chalico reared and brought its scimitar claws down onto the rump of a soldier's animal. The Japanese warrior, shouting an ancient battle cry, forced his own mount to ramp again and again with terrible driving blows that crushed the soldier and his Chalico into the tangled mass already on the ground. The second Ronin came up on foot and grasped a lance from its scabbard on the fallen man's saddle.
"A bear dog! Behind you, Tat!"
Richard yelled. The warrior whirled around and braced the spear on the ground as the amphibian leaped. Transfixed through the neck, the animal body continued forward on momentum and crushed the Ronin named Tat beneath its great bulk. Richard ran forward and stabbed the struggling monster in its near eye, then tried to haul it off the warrior, but someone shouted, "Here comes another one!" And Richard looked up to see a black shape with gleaming eyes not 4 meters away. Felice gazed impassively at the fight, her face almost hidden within the T-shaped helmet opening. The charging amphibian swerved away from Richard and ran over the edge of the steep embankment, squalling in midair and striking the water with a tremendous splash. Basil and the Knight Dougal rode with their mounts impotently around the edge of the bedlam of noise, hesitating before the flailing bloody claws and struggling shapes. Ripping off the impeding veil and wimple, Richard picked up another lance and tossed it to Basil. Instead of stabbing with it, the climber hoisted the thing like a javelin, threw, and hit one of the soldiers high on the armor of his upper back. The point of the weapon skidded up beneath the man's kettle helmet, penetrating the base of his skull. He fell like a bag of sand. Felice watched. No more bear dogs came from the shadowy perimeter. All that were left alive were busy worrying something lying next to the body of a dead white Chalico. A single soldier stood upright among them, hacking slowly at the snarling amphibians like some freshly painted red automaton.
"You must kill him," Felice said.
They could not find any more lances. Richard ran to the mounted knight, handed up his bronze sword, and pointed.
"Take him, Dougal."
As if in a trance, the elegant medievalist grasped the weapon and waited for a suitable moment before riding into the mass of dead and dying animals and men. He decapitated the futile chopping figure with a single blow. There were 2 bear dogs left alive as the last soldier fell. Richard found another sword and prepared to stand his ground if they came after him, but the creature seemed seized with a kind of fit. They backed away from their prey reluctantly, giving vent to agonized howls, then turned and went leaping to their doom over the edge of the lakeside cliff. The sky was becoming rose-colored.
There were gagging sounds and hysterical sobs as the stunned prisoners, who had been herded into a compact group by Claude and Amory during the embroilment, now came slowly forward to look. Noises from dying Chalicos were cut short as the surviving Ronin went about with a dispatching sword. The first morning notes of song sparrows, simple and solemn as Gregorian chant, echoed among the lofty sequoia trunks. Felice rose up in her saddle, arms wide, fingers grasping, head in its plumed helmet thrown back as she writhed, cried out, then slumped back inertly against the high cantle. The Japanese bent over the gory carcass of the white chalico. He grunted and beckoned to Richard. Numbed now, feeling only curiosity, the former starship captain went stumbling into the fleshly wreckage, hindered by his incongruous nun's garb. On the ground, amidst the bodies, was a hideously gnawed, limbless trunk, swathed in bloody rags. The face was torn to the bone all along one side, but the other was still beautiful and untouched. An eyelid opened. A jade-green orb reached out at Richard. Ippon's mind took hold of him and began to drag him down. He screamed. His bronze sword hewed and stabbed at the thing down there, but its inexorable grip held him. The dawnlight began to fade, and he was being taken to a place from which he would not return.
"Iron!"
the high-pitched voice of the night called out.
"Iron! Only thus may the fairy perish!"
The useless sword fell, and Richard fumbled at his wrist. As he continued to sink, he clutched at the instrument of redemption and sent its steely potency deep between the heaving white-scarlet ribs without breasts to the raging heart, stilling it and quenching the body's resident spirit which took flight, releasing as it was released. Basil and the Ronin hauled Richard out of there by the arms. He was wide-eyed and still screaming, but holding tight to the gold-handled knife. The three men paid no attention to the demented Dougal, who leaped from his saddle and began stomping something beneath his mailed feet. Felice shouted a warning, ignoring her. The knight picked a blood-smeared golden hoop from the mess and scaled it far out over the lake, where it sank without a trace. 14. The riverside palace at Darisk was in an uproar when the southbound travelers broke their journey there on the second evening. The mistress of the establishment had been brought to childbed with twins, and her labor was proving dangerously prolonged. Freyan went off to volunteer his medical services, leaving the prisoners in the care of a silver-torqued majordomo, a black Irishman who forthrightly introduced himself as Huey B. Kennedy VII, and led them under guard to a large chamber high in one tower of the palace.
"You'll have to rough it tonight, friends," Kennedy said. "Boys and girls together, here where we can keep you secure easily. We can't spare the guards tonight for single quarters, not with our poor Lady Estella Sirone hovering on the brink, and the Bugger and Firvala gathering round, knowing what's in the wind. You'll be cool up here at any rate and above the mosquitoes. There's a good supper out on the balcony table."
The escorting palace guards carried in Stein's litter and rolled the Viking onto one of the netting-draped bedsteads. Suki protested.
"But he needs care. He hasn't eaten or drunk all day or anything."
"Don't fret yourself over him," Kennedy said. "When they're put under with the torque," and he fingered his own, "they're like in suspended animation. Your friend is just a hibernating animal, metabolism all slowed down. He'll keep until tomorrow. By then, please Jesus, all'll be well with our lady and we can spare some time for him."
The majordomo gave Suki a shrewd look.
"Likely you'll keep a good eye on your friend?"
The prisoners were allowed to take a change of clothing but nothing else from their packs, which were then removed by the guards. Kennedy apologized once more for the meagerness of their welcome and prepared to lock them in. Elizabeth came to him and said in a low voice,
"I must speak privately to Cran. It's important."
The majordomo frowned.
"Ma'am, I realize that you're a privileged person, but my orders were to install all of you together here."
Kennedy. I'm an operant metapsychic and a trained redactor. I can't get through to Crayon, but I can far sense your lady and her unborn babies. And I know that right this moment they're in serious trouble. I can't help them from here. But if you take me down to the birthing room... There. Crayon's calling for me. Kennedy had heard the telepathic summons, too. Come along, then. Taking her by one arm, he drew her into the tower corridor and slammed the door shut. Ramo said sourly,
"That was nice going. We get stuck here, but little Red Riding Britches gets to see the fireworks."
"I never would have pegged you as an obstetrics freak," Aiken jeered.
"Didn't you hear that guy?" Ramo's pale eyes glistened, and he licked his lips.
"He said the Fearfulug were going to lay siege to the place. I want to see that. Maybe get in on the fighting."
Suki's face was twisted with scorn.
"You just can't wait to join the hunt, can you? Can't wait to get some monster's head on a pike. But you weren't so brave when we were shooting those rapids today."
Leaving them to their bickering, Brian and a strangely subdued Aiken Drum went out to the balcony. The promised supper had enough food for a dozen people, but all of it was cold and bore evidence of hasty preparation. Aiken picked up the leg of a roast fowl and took an uninterested bite, meanwhile inspecting the security arrangements of the balcony. It was completely enclosed in a cage of ornamental brass grillwork.
"I won't be flying out of here very quickly, will I? I suppose I could saw through the bars with one of the little Vitrador gizmos I have in my pockets, but it hardly seems worthwhile trying to escape. They've got me so curious about the town of Goodlife that running away seems stupid."
"I believe that's the attitude you're supposed to form," Brian said. "You were allowed to taste just enough of your new powers to want a whole lot more. Now they've taken your metafunctions away until you submit to their training regimen down in the capital, and they make you into a good little copy of themselves."
"So you think that'll happen, do you?"
Aiken's gollywog grin was as wide as ever, but his black button eyes held an ugly glitter.
"You don't know a fucking thing about me, and the way my mind works. As for the metabilities, you're only a normal. You've never tasted the powers, and you never will. So don't give me any of your high-ass professor's predictions about the way I'm going to behave."
"They've got you collared and liking it," Brian said mildly. Aiken touched the silver neck ring with a dismissive flick.
"This thing, it's only put a clamp on my metafunctions. The clamp is effective now because I haven't figured out how to turn it off. But I'm working on it. You think they've got me under control? What Crayon did at the very beginning was program this inhibitory thing on us. There's this little nagger in the skull that hints at horrible things happening to us if we try to escape or do anything to threaten the peace and good order of our wonderful Tanu friends. You know how much that inhibition is worth influencing me? It isn't worth shit. Little Suki and Dumbo Ray in there are safe, but not Aiken Drum."
"The Torx, have you discovered how the different kinds work?"
"Not the details, but enough. One of the Tanner women at the Renaya party spilled a lot when I put it to her nicely. The old Torx are the basic article, the mental amplifiers that turn latents into operants. They're stuffed with barium chips, all latticed with microscopic amounts of rare earth and bits of other junk that these jokers brought with them from their home galaxy. They handcraft the Torx and have a machine to grow and print the chips. They hardly understand how the machine functions, and most of them know even less about the theory behind the Torx themselves, the whole metapsychic thing. The technology of it is handled down in the capital city by some outfit called the Coercer Guild."
"Do the Golden Torx have differing powers of magnification?"
"They're all exactly the same. And all they magnify is what the individual's got. If a guy's got one weaky ability latent, he becomes an operant weaky. If he's loaded with all five metafunctions and wholesale lots, he becomes operant as the Wizard of Oz. Most of the Tano are fairly strong in just one metafunction, and they tend to club up with others of the same type. The folks who have several strong powers are the real aristocrats. Just what you'd expect. It's the same sort of setup that you get in the milieu, only on a pipsqueak scale, with everyone pretty much out for what he can get. Near as I can tell so far, there are no masterclass metas here, and nothing like the milieu psycho union. Brian slowly nodded. I'd already sensed a lack of hierarchy among these people. I wouldn't be surprised to find them still at the clan level of socialization. Fascinating. And almost unprecedented, given the high culture trappings.
They're barbarians, Aiken stated flatly. That's one of the things I like about them. And they're not too proud to let us human latents join right in.
With silver torques. Aiken gave a short laugh.
Yeah. These silver collars have all the mind-expanding functions of the gold plus control circuits. The gray torques and the small collars of the monkeys have nothing but controls, plus a bunch of pleasure-pain circuits and a telepathic communication thing that varies a lot in its range.
Brian peered over the edge of the balcony. Can you get any mental clues as to what's going on around here? Quite a few alarms and excursions down there. I'm getting very curious about the Firvalog by now.
Funny thing about those severed heads the hunt brought in.
Aiken frowned.
They weren't quite dead, some of them. And after a while they started to... how can I say it? Flicker. The hunters took them away, so we never really got a good look at them. But there was something subliminal about the whole scene.
Suki and Ramo chose that moment to come out in search of dinner. Aiken asked them,
"You guys hear anything? With your minds? I've tried, but this damn Lockran put in me screens out all but whispers."
Suki closed her eyes and put her fingers in her ears. Ramo just stood there with his mouth open, finally saying,
"Hell, all I hear is my stomach rumbling. Let me at that food."
After a few minutes had passed with Aiken and Brian watching her patiently, Suki opened her eyes.
"I get eagerness from a lot of mental sources that seem to be different, broadcasting on another wavelength from humans, even different from Tanu. I can tune them in, but it's hard. Do you understand what I mean?"
"We understand, kiddo," Aiken said.
Suki glanced from him to Brian anxiously.
"What do you suppose it could be?"
"Nothing to bother us, I'm sure," Brian said.
Suki murmured something about wanting to sit with Stein, and took a plate of fruit and cold meat inside. Brian was satisfied with a roughly made sandwich and a mug of some cider-like beverage. He stood looking over twilit Varisk. In the east, the monstrous rampart of the Maritime Alps still reflected glaring sunset pink on the highest snowfields. Extraordinary, Brian thought. The mountains look to be as high as the spine of the Himalaya, or even the Hlafskjalf Massif on Asgard. A cool wind was coming down from the heights, spreading across the Everglade flats where the Rhone finally relaxed and spread wide after its precipitate plunge from the region around unborn Lyon. The day's journey had been something like descending a series of vast canyoned steps. They would sail peacefully for 30 or 40 kilometers, then encounter savage rapids that would shoot them to the next lower level at jet boat velocity. Despite Skipper Hijan's reassurances, Brian felt that he had survived the ordeal of a lifetime. The last stretch of rapids, occurring, as he had suspected, in the gorge area about 50 kilometers above the future Pont d'Avignon, had been formidable beyond belief. The prolongation of terror had blunted his senses to the point of stupor. Aikendrum had begged Crayon not to put him to sleep for that last rough ride, being eager for some taste of the thrills that Brian had described. When the boat had tumbled end over end down the face of the final great cataract and fetched up in the placid Lac Provençal, Aiken's face had turned to gray-green, and his bright eyes were sunken in shock.
"A fucking flea ride," he had moaned, "in a fucking food blender."
By the time they reached Darisk on the lower Rhone, they had journeyed nearly 270 kilometers in less than 10 hours. The shallowing river twined and split and braided itself into scores of channels, divided by rippling grasslands and mudflats
inhabited by flocks of long-legged birds and cream and black checkered crocodiles. Here and there, islands rose from the marshy plain. Darisk crowned one of them, looking for all the world like a tropical Mont Saint-Michel, towering above a sea of grass. Their boat had used its auxiliary engine to move out of the mainstream of the Rhone into a secondary channel leading to the fortified town. Darisk had a small key secured behind a limestone wall more than 12 meters high that butted against unscalable cliffs. And now, in the town beneath the high-rising palace, Ramas were lighting the small night lamps, clambering up spindly ladders to tend those on brackets along the house roofs, working pulleys to raise long strings of lanterns up the face of the inner fortifications. Human soldiers touched off larger torches on the bastions of the town's perimeter. As Brian and the others surveyed the scene, the peculiar Tanu-style illumination sprang into operation, outlining the spired palace in dots of red and amber that symbolized the heraldic colors of its psychokinetic lord, Cranovel. Aiken inspected the Tanu lamps along their own balcony. They were of sturdy faceted glass resting in small niches in the stone, without wires or any other metallic attachments. They were cold.
Bioluminescence, the little man in gold decided, shaking one. You wanna bet there are microorganisms in here? What did Crayon say? That the lights were energized by surplus meta-emanations? That figures. You get some of the lower echelon torque wearers to generate a suitable waveform while they're playing checkers or drinking beer or reading in the bathtub or performing some other semi-automatic.
Brian was paying scant attention to Aiken's speculations. Out in the surrounding marshland, the Ignis Fatui were lighting their own lamps. Wispy blobs of methane blue, firefly glimmerings that winked on and off in scattered synchrony, wandering pale flames gliding around the island's misty backwaters like lost elfin boats.
I suppose those are glowing insects or marsh gas flames out there, Suki said, coming up behind Brian to stare into the darkening landscape.
Ramo said, Now I hear something, but not with any meta faculty. You guys catching it?
They listened. Suki pursed her lips in exasperation.
Frogs!
An almost inaudible trill was building up on the breeze, swelling and finally fracturing into a complex treble chord of tinkles and peeps. An invisible Batrachian maestro lowered his baton and more voices chimed in. Gulps and grunts, rattling snares, pops and clicks, tunking notes as of hollow canes. Additional frog voices contributed their simulations of slowly dripping water, plucked strings, human glottal trills, buzzing drill bits, amplified guitar notes, and underwriting it all was the homely jug-a-rum of the common bullfrog, that durable earth creature that would, in only 6 million years, accompany mankind on its colonization of the far-flung stars. The four people on the balcony looked at one another and burst into laughter.
"We've got a front-row seat," Aiken said, "in case there's any Fervalog invasion. And this blue pitcher is full of something that's cool and definitely alcoholic. Shall we pull up chairs and fortify ourselves just in case the monsters arrive on schedule?"
"All in favor?" Brian demanded.
"Aye!"
They took out their mugs, and the little man in gold filled them one by one. Elizabeth pressed the back of her hand to her clammy forehead. Her eyes opened, and she exhaled a long, slow breath. Crayon and a haggard Tanu man in a rumpled yellow robe bent anxiously over her chair. Crayon's mind touched hers, supporting, querying.
"Yes, I have separated them, finally. Sorry, so weak, my skill, rusty, disuse. They will be born now."
The mind of Lord Cranival of Darisk wept gratitude. "And she? Safe? Oh, safe, my darling?"
"Human women tougher than Tano. She recovers easily now."
He cried aloud, "Estella Cerone," and ran to the inner chamber. In a few moments, the querulous wail of a newborn infant came to the two who still waited. Elizabeth smiled at Cran. The first grayness of dawn lighted the mist outside the palace windows. Elizabeth said, "I've never handled anything quite like that before. The two unborn minds, so intertwined, so mutually antagonistic. Fraternal twins, of course. But it seems incredible that genuine enmity should have been able to..."
A Tano woman dressed all in red put her head through the curtained doorway and exclaimed,
"A lovely girl! The next one is a breach, but we'll get it safely, never fear."
She disappeared again. Elizabeth got up from the chair and walked wearily to the window, letting her mind reach out beyond the birthing rooms for the first time since she had entered so many hours ago. The anomalies were outside, crowding closer and stumbling over one another in horrid eagerness. Those twittering little unhuman minds, seemingly operant, changing their soul form even as she tried to grasp them for examination. They eluded her, wove disguises, faded and flared, shrunk to atomies or expanded into looming monsters that postured in the mental physical fog swirling about the towers of the island palace. Another baby cried. Pierced by a terrible realization, Elizabeth's mind met that of Crayon. A slow, distilling drop of regret formed from a complex of the man's emotions. Then he slammed down an impervious screen between them. Elizabeth ran to the door of the inner chamber and pushed the draperies aside. Several women, both human and Tanu, were attendant upon the new mother, a human wearing a golden torque. Estella Cerrone was smiling, the beautiful baby girl held to her right breast. Pranival knelt beside her, wiping her brow. The Tanu nurse, in red, brought the other baby to show to Elizabeth. It was a very small boy, weighing about 2 kilos, wizened as an old man, and with an oversized head thickly covered with wet, dark hair. Its eyes were wide open, and it screeched thinly from a mouth that had a full set of tiny, sharp teeth. Even as Elizabeth watched, the mannequin shimmered and became furry all over its body, then shimmered again and turned to a virtual double of its plump, blonde sister.
"It is a Fervalog, a shape-changer," the nurse said. "They are the shadow brethren of the Tanu from the Foundation of Worlds. Ever with us, ever against us. The twin situation is fortunately rare. Most such die unborn, and the mother with them."
"What will you do with him?" Elizabeth asked. Fascinated, horrified, she sounded the small alien mentality and recognized the anomalous mode, now that it was fully separated from the more complex psychic structure of the Tanu sister. The tall nurse shrugged.
"His folk are awaiting him, and so we give him to them as always. You would like to see it?"
Dumbly, Elizabeth nodded. The nurse swiftly wrapped the baby in a soft towel and hurried out of the birthing room. Elizabeth had all she could do to keep up as the woman raced down flight after flight of stone stairs, all empty and echoing, and lit only by the tiny ruby and amber lamps. They finally came to a cellar. A dank corridor led to the outer wall of the town, and a great locked water gate, beside which was an indoor anchorage full of deserted small boats. The gate had a wicket with a bronze bolt, which the exotic woman shot open.
"Guard your mind," she warned,
and stepped outside onto the fog-obscured dock. There were lights out there, and they converged with alarming speed, making no sound whatsoever. Then came a single deep green glow that became a sphere some 4 meters across, rolling on the surface of the water and burning the mist to shreds as it approached the dock. With great caution, Elizabeth pried apart the fabric of the illusion and looked inside. There was a boat, a punt rather, with a dwarfish fellow poling and a round-cheeked little woman sitting in the bows with a covered basket in her lap.
"So you see us, do you?"
Elizabeth staggered as a barrage of lightning seemed to explode behind her eyes. Her tongue swelled as if to strangle her.
The flesh of her hands blistered, blackened, burst, and cooked in a living flame.
That'll show the upstart.
I warned you, said the Tano woman. Elizabeth felt the tall one's arms around her, holding her up. She saw only the glowing ball receding into the mist. Her mouth was normal, her hands unhurt. The Firvalag are operant metapsychics of a sort. All most of them can do is far-sense and spin illusions, but those can be strong enough to drive an unready mind mad. We handle them well enough, at grand combat time and at most other times too, but you must not let them take you unaware. The baby was gone. After a few seconds, the green glow vanished as well, and daylight broke fitfully through rags of vapor. Far up on the battlements, a woman's voice was singing alien words to a familiar melody.
"We'll go back now," the nurse said. "My lord and lady will be very grateful to you. You must receive proper thanks, then refreshment and rest. There is a small family ceremony, naming the child and giving her the first tiny golden torque. They will wish you to hold the baby. It is a great honor."
"Imagine me as fairy godmother," Elizabeth murmured. "What a world! Are you going to name her after me as well?"
"She already has a name. It is traditional among us to give anew the name of one who has recently passed on to Tana's peace. The baby will be called Ipone. And the goddess grant that she be more fortunate than the last who bore that name."
15. Amari came down to the lakeshore, where the freed prisoners were ballasting their hastily inflated boats.
"I've had to sedate Felice. She was ready to tear the poor Nadi apart."
"Not surprising," Claude growled. "Once I'd thought the matter through, I was tempted along those lines myself."
Richard was treading siphon bulbs with both feet, flooding the interstices of his and Claude's beach dinghies, while the old man loaded equipment into the two small decimal craft. Richard had changed back into his pirate costume, curtly telling the nun to keep his spacer's coverall for the duration. Now he glowered at her.
"Maybe Dougal did us all a favor without knowing it. How do we know what Felice would turn into once she got hold of a golden torque?"
"There's that," Claude had to admit. "But if she'd got it, we wouldn't have to worry about any immediate danger from the soldiers. As it is, some kind of armed force is going to be breathing down our necks any minute now. We couldn't have been far from the next fort when the fight started."
Amory said, "You two come up and help me with Felice when you finish here. Yosha's been going through the baggage packs, retrieving some of our stuff."
"Any weapons?" Richard asked.
"They seem to have left ours back at the castle, but most of the tools are there, no maps or compasses, I'm afraid."
Claude and Richard shared a glance. The paleontologist said,
"Men, it's seat-of-the-pants navigation, and devil take the hindmost. You go on up, Amory, we'll be along in a few minutes."
In the aftermath of the flight, when all of the prisoners had been released, they had held a hasty conference and decided that the best chance of escape lay in taking to the water. One or two people to a decimal dinghy from the survival units. Only the five gypsies had ignored Claude's warning about the dangers of riding the torque-susceptible chalicos. They had gone back to attack the suspension bridge guard post after donning the gory armor of the slain escort and taking most of the soldiers' weaponry. The remaining escapees had re-established the bonding forged at the auberge, the original groups coming together once more to plan their collective getaway. Claude, the only person with a working knowledge of the Pliocene landscape, had suggested two possible escape routes. The one that would take them most quickly to rugged country entailed a short voyage northeast, across the narrow upper portion of the Lac de Bresse, to canyons leading into the hastily forested Vosges Highlands. This had the disadvantage of crossing the main trail to Fenaya, on the opposite shore of the lake. But if they managed to elude mounted patrols, they could reach the high country before nightfall and hole up among the rocks. The second route would have them sailing southeast across the widest part of the lake to the shore of the Jura Piedmont some 60 kilometers away, then continuing south into the mountain range itself. There seemed an excellent chance that the land in that direction was completely uninhabited, since beyond the Jura lay the Alps. On the other hand, the lakeside forts were likely to have boats of their own that could be used for pursuit. The escapees might outsail the Tanu minions, but the breeze was fitful, and the nearly cloudless sky suggested that the air might go dead calm as it had the day before. If the boats were becalmed at nightfall, they might attract the attention of the Firvalag. Basil had confidently elected for the Jura route, while Claude's conservatism inclined him to hold out for the Vosges. But the climber was most persuasive to the majority. So in the end it was decided that all of the time travelers except the remnant of Group Green and Yosh, the surviving Ronin, would go south. The prisoners had hastily unloaded their baggage from the Chalicos and followed a gully down to a tiny beach below the cliff. There, boats could be launched. A few of the small craft were already spreading their sails when Richard completed ballasting the two green boats and scrambled back up the embankment in search of the others. He discovered Claude, Amory, and Yosh standing over Felice's unconscious body. The Japanese warrior said,
"I've found Claude's woodworking tools and the knives and hatchets and saws from our survival and smallholder units." He held out a hideously stained packet to Richard. "And here are also a soldier's bow and arrows that the gypsies overlooked."
"We're grateful, Yosh," said the old man. "The bow could be very important. We have very little food except for the survival rations, and the kits have only snares and fishing gear. The people going south with Basil will have time to make new weapons if they reach the Jura shore, but our group will be in much more danger of land pursuit. We will have to keep moving and do our hunting on the run."
"But you should go with us, Yosh," Amory said. "Won't you change your mind?"
"I have my own survival unit and task lance. I'll take the rest of the tools that I scavenged down to the people on the shore. But I won't go with them, and I won't go with you."
He gestured to the sky, where dark specks were already circling in the morning gold.
"I have a duty here. The Reverend Sister has given my poor friend the blessing of departure. But Tat must not be left to the scavengers. When I've finished, I plan to head due north on foot to the River Marne. It joins the Pliocene Seine, and the Seine flows into the Atlantic. I don't think the Tanu will bother to track one man."
"Well, don't hang around here too long," Richard said dubiously.
The Ronin knelt swiftly beside Felice's limp form and kissed her brow. His grim eyes swept those of the others.
"You must take good care of this mad child. We owe her our freedom, and if God wills, she may yet accomplish her purpose. The potential rests in her."
"We know," said the nun. "Go blessed, Yoshimitsu-san."
The warrior got to his feet, bowed, and left them.
"Time for us to go, too," said Claude.
He and Amory picked up the pathetically light body of the girl, while Richard gathered her helmet and pack, together with the tools and weapons.
"I can sail single-handed," the pirate said when they reached the waiting boats. "Put Felice in with me and you two follow."
They shoved off, the last to set sail, and relaxed only when they were far out from land. The lake waters were cold and of an opaque blue, fed by rivers running out of the Jura and the Vosges forest to the northeast. Amory stared at the receding shore, where carrion birds were gradually descending.
"Claude, I've been thinking. Why didn't Ippone die sooner from those dreadful wounds? She was literally torn to pieces before Richard and Yosh and Dougal ever got near her. She should have bled to death or died from hypovolemic shock, but she didn't."
"The people at the fort told you that the Tanu were nearly invulnerable. What did you think they meant?"
"I don't know. Perhaps I assumed that the exotics were able to use their coercive power to fend off attackers. But I never dreamed a Tanu could survive such physical punishment.
It's hard not to think of them as approximately human, given that breeding scheme Ikone spoke to us about.
Even human beings without metafunctions have been mighty tenacious of life. I've seen things in the colonies that were damn near miraculous, and when you consider the enhancement of mental powers that the Tanu achieve with the Torque...
I wonder if they have regenerative facilities here in exile.
I should think so, in the cities, and God knows what other kinds of technology they have. So far we've only seen the Torques, the Mind Assayer, and that frisking device they used on us when we first came through the time portal.
Ah, yes, and that brings us to the lethal dagger. The old man stripped off his bush jacket and pillowed his back against one of the boat seats.
I don't doubt that our anthropologist friend Brian could tell us all about the legendary fairy antipathy toward iron. He'd probably explain it in terms of the ancient tensions between Bronze Age and Iron Age cultures. Be that as it may, European folklore is almost universal in believing that iron is repugnant or even deadly to the old people.
The nun burst out, "Oh, for heaven's sake, Claude, Ikone was an exotic, not some bloody elf."
"Then you tell me why bear dog bites and dismemberment and stab wounds from a bronze sword didn't finish her off, while a single thrust from a steel knife blade did,"
Amory considered. "It may be that the iron interferes in some way with the function of the Torque. The blood of the Tanu is red just like ours and probably just as iron-rich. Their bodies and minds, and the Torque, might operate in a delicate harmony that could be upset by the introduction of a gross mass of iron. Iron might even wonk them up if it just came near the body's intimate aura. Remember Stein and his battle axe? None of the castle people was able to prevent him from doing terrible damage, which didn't strike me as strange at the time, but with what we know now, it seems significant."
"They frisked us thoroughly enough," Claude said. "I can understand why the Guardians weren't able to pry Stein loose from his axe. But how did Felice's knife slip through?"
"I can't imagine, unless they were careless and didn't sweep her leg, or perhaps the gold of the scabbard confused the detector. It suggests possibilities for counter-tactics." Claude studied her through half-closed lids. There was an intensity about her that was new and startling.
"Now you're beginning to sound like Felice. That child has no qualms about taking on the whole Tanu race. Never mind that they control the Frigerty planet."
Amory flashed him an odd smile. "But it's our planet. And 6 million years from now, we'll be here, and they won't." She snugged the tiller under her arm and kept the boat racing eastward, its sail taut before the freshening breeze. They came up behind a marshy island, hauled down sails and unstepped and deflated masts and centerboards. Armloads of reeds and young willows were cut to disguise the boats. They substituted rear-mounted decimal sculling oars for the sailing rudders. A person crouched low in the stern could impart a barely perceptible forward motion by wagging the oar back and forth. Richard protested,
"It'll take us 2 hours to travel the half-kilometer to shore at this rate."
"Keep your voice down," Claude warned him. "Sound travels over water."
He brought his boat close to Richard's.
"Somewhere on that shore is the trail, maybe even the fort, where we were scheduled to stop for sleep this morning. We've got to be careful about showing ourselves until we're sure the coast is clear."
Richard laughed nervously.
"The coast is clear. So that's where the cliché came from. Probably pirates."
"Shut up, son," said the old man, weariness making his low voice harsh. "Just follow me from here on in and pretend you're a collection of flotsam."
Claude sculled so slowly that there was no wake. They seemed to drift from islet to islet, gradually approaching a low-lying shore where reeds and sedges grew more than 5 meters tall, and long-shanked waterbirds with plumage of pink and blue and dazzling white
stalked the shallows, jabbing at frogs and fish with their beaks. The sun rose higher. It became excruciatingly hot and humid. Some kind of biting midge zeroed in on them, trapped as they were beneath the concealing greenery, and raised itching welts before they could find repellent in their awkwardly stowed packs. After a tedious interval of paddling, they scraped bottom on a jungly mudflat where many of the bamboos had trunks as thick as a man's thigh. Broadleaf evergreen trees perfumed the air with sickly sweet flowers. There was a game trail in the mud, heavily trampled by large, flat feet. It looked as though it would lead them to higher ground.
"This is it," Claude said. "We deflate the dinghies and hike from here."
Richard extracted himself from the mass of stalks and branches in his boat and surveyed the sight with disgust.
"Jesus, Claude, did you have to land us on a fucking swamp? Talk about your green hells. This place is probably crawling with snakes. And will you look at those footprints? Some mighty ugly mother's been cruising through here."
"Oh, stuff it, Richard," Amory said. "Help me get Felice ashore, and I'll try to revive her while you guys..."
"Get down, everybody!"
the old man whispered urgently.
They crouched low in the boats and stared in the direction from which they had come. Out beyond the marshy little islands, where the lake was deep and the breeze blew unimpeded, were a pair of 7-meter catboats that bore no resemblance to any of the craft launched by the escapees. They were slowly tacking northward.
"Well, now we know where the fort must be," Claude remarked. "South of here and most likely not very far away. They've probably got oculars on board, so we'll have to stay down until they get around that point."
They waited. Sweat trickled down various body surfaces and made them itch. The frustrated midges whined and went on sorties against their unprotected eyeballs and nostrils. Claude's belly rumbled, reminding him that he had not eaten in nearly 12 hours. Richard discovered a sticky gash hidden in the hair above his left ear, and so did the local variety of blowfly. Amory made a desultory attempt to pray, but her memory bank refused to pay out any withdrawals, except the grace before meals, and "now I lay me down to sleep." Felice moaned.
"Cover her mouth, Richard," Claude said. "Keep her quiet for just a few minutes longer."
Somewhere ducks were quacking. Somewhere else, an animal was snuffling and slurping and breaking the giant bamboos like twigs as it sought its lunch. And elsewhere still, the silver sound of a horn sang on the limit of audibility, to be followed seconds later by a louder response farther north. The old paleontologist sighed.
"They're out of sight. Let's deflate these boats and move on."
The power inflators used in reverse swiftly sucked both air and water out of the decimal membranes, reducing the boats to spheres the size of ping-pong balls. While Amory reviled Felice with a dose of stimulant, Claude rummaged in his pack for survival ration biscuits and fortified candy, which he shared with the others. Felice was listless and disoriented, but seemed well enough to walk. Claude tried to get her to remove her leather cuirass, greaves, and gauntlets, which had to be acutely uncomfortable in the muggy atmosphere of the marsh, but she refused, only agreeing to keep her helmet stowed in the pack when Claude pointed out that its plumage might betray them to searchers. As a final ritual, they daubed each other with camouflaging mud, then set off with Claude in the lead, Richard following, and Amory and Felice bringing up the rear. The ring hockey player had appropriated the bow and arrows. They went quietly along the trail, which was wide enough for them to travel in comfort, a circumstance that pleased Richard and the women, but rather alarmed the more wilderness-wise Claude. For 2 kilometers they slogged through stands of bamboo, alder, willow, and semi-tropical evergreens, some trees laden with fruits of russet and purple, which Claude warned them against sampling. To their surprise, the only wildlife encountered was birds and giant leeches. The ground became higher and drier, and they passed into dense forest, loud with bird and animal voices. The trees were draped in vines, and the undergrowth formed a mass of impenetrable thorn bushes on both sides of the trail. At length, the gloomy greenness gave way to sunlight as the trees thinned. Claude held up his hand as a signal for them to stop.
"Not a peep out of you," he breathed. "I was half expecting to meet something like this."
They gazed through a thin screen of young trees into an open meadow with scattered clumps of bushes. Cropping the shrubbery was a herd of 6 adult and 3 juvenile rhinos. The full-grown specimens were about 4 meters in length and might have weighed 2 or 3 tons. They had 2 horns, piggy little eyes, and quaintly tufted ears that waggled as flies buzzed around them.
"Dicero rhinus sclere macere, I'd say," Claude whispered. "This is their trail we've been using."
Felice stepped forward, knocking the razor-sharp arrow.
"It's a good thing the wind is with us. Let me feel around their minds for a while and see if I can move them,"
Richard said.
"Meanwhile, we can hope they don't get thirsty."
Leaving Felice to experiment with her coercive power, the others withdrew back along the trail into a sunny glen at one side, where they sat down to rest. Richard planted a straight stick about as long as his arm upright in a patch of soil, marking the position of the shadow's tip with a small stone.
"Making a sundial?" Amory inquired.
The pirate grimaced.
"If we stay here long enough, we can get a fix. The tip of the shadow moves as the sun seems to travel across the sky. You wait, mark the new position of the shadow tip with another stone. Connect the 2 stones with a line, and you got an east-west bearing. If we want to reach those highlands by the shortest route, I think we've got to bear more to the left than we've been going on this trail."
It was nearly an hour before Felice returned to tell them that it was safe to cross the meadow. They chose a new route according to Richard's aboriginal navigation, but without a convenient animal track to follow, they were forced to cross country through the tangled, thorn-choked forest understory. It was impossible to travel quietly, and the wildlife was making a racket like feeding time at the zoo. So they threw caution to the winds and broke out the Vitrador hatchets and Claude's big carpenter's axe and hacked a trail. After 2 exhausting hours of this, they came upon a sizable creek and were able to follow it upstream into a slightly more open section of forest.
"We're on the bench above the lake now," Claude said. "The trail to the fort must be near. Be very quiet, and keep your ears open."
They crept onward, skulking in the shadows of giant conifers, cycads, and ferns. Anticlimactically, they blundered right into the trail when they had to alter course to avoid a spiderweb the size of a banquet tablecloth. The bush-constricted track was deserted. Felice bent over a pile of calico dung.
"Cold. They must have passed here 2 hours ago. See the prince heading north?"
"They'll be coming back," Claude said, "and if they have amphibians, they'll be able to track us. Let's blot out our own prints and get out of here. Once we get higher, there should be fewer trees and easier going. We'll have to follow another stream somewhere to kill our scent."
The trees did become more widely separated as they continued upslope, but the going was hardly easy. They followed a dry water course for most of an hour before the gentle grade above the bench steepened to a bluff studded with house-sized chunks of rock. The wind died, and the heat of mid-afternoon smote them as they climbed. At times, when they rested, they could see out over the Great Lake. There were sails far to the south, apparently motionless on the water. It was impossible to tell whether they belonged to the Grey Torque Marines or to the escapees. They wondered out loud about the fate of Basil and his contingent, about Yosh, and about the gypsies and their quixotic foray against the guard post. But the trail talk dwindled as they were forced to save their breath for more difficult climbing. Hope that they would be able to cross the first high ridge began to fade after one of Richard's Plasson fabric running shoes was slashed by a rock, and he had to put on the more awkward sea boots of his original costume. Then Amory's saddle-sore legs betrayed her on a treacherous slope, and she lost her footing, dislodging several large stones that tumbled down upon Claude and bruised his arm and shoulder.
"We'll never make it to the top today," Richard groused. "My left heel is one big blister, and Amory is ready to collapse.
Felice said, "It's only a couple of hundred more meters. If you can't climb, I'll carry you up. I want to get a good view of the terrain we're heading into tomorrow. With luck, we might be able to see the bonfires from the fort, or even trail beacons below us once it gets dark." Claude declared he could manage on his own. Felice gave one hand to Richard and the other to the nun and hauled them up after her by main strength. It was slow going, but they were finally able to reach the top shortly after the sun descended behind the hills on the other side of the lake. When they had regained their wind, Claude said, "Why don't we hole up on the eastern side of these big boulders? There's a nice dry shelter in there, and I don't think anyone below could spot a fire if we lit one after nightfall. I could gather some wood."
"Good idea," said Felice. "I'll scout around a bit."
She went off among the crags and gnarled savin junipers, while the others tended their wounds, inflated decimal cots, and weighted the legs with earth, because there was no water to waste, and regretfully laid out a meal of biscuits, nutrient wafers, and cheesy-tasting algaprote. By the time Claude had assembled a pile of dry branches, Felice was back, her bow resting jauntily over her shoulder, swinging three fat marmot-like animals by their hind legs.
"Hail Diana!" chortled the old man. "I'll even skin and clean 'em."
They lit the fire after it was completely dark and roasted the meat, devouring every gamey morsel. Then Richard and Claude collapsed onto their cots and were asleep in minutes. Amory, her brain buzzing with fatigue, still felt obliged to shake the grease and scraps off the dinnerware, sterilize them with the power source, then shrink and stow them away. "There's my big helpful girl."
"I can see the fort," came Felice's voice from the nearby darkness.
Amory picked her way over the rocks to where the athlete was standing. The ridge fell steeply to the southwest. The young moon hung over the lake, and an incredible profusion of Pliocene stars reflected upon the water, differentiating it from the black land. Far to the south, on their side of the lake, was a cluster of orange specks.
"How far away is it?" the nun asked.
"At least 15 kilometers, maybe more as the vulture flies."
Felice laughed, and Amory was suddenly wide awake, experiencing the same feeling of fear and fascination she had known before. The woman beside her was an indistinct silhouette in the starlight, but Amory knew that Felice was looking at her.
"They didn't thank me," the athlete said in a low voice. "I set them free, but they didn't thank me. They were afraid of me still. And that fool of a Dougal? None of them, not even you, sympathized or understood why I wanted to—"
"But you couldn't kill Dougal. For the love of God, Felice, I had to put you out."
"Killing him would have been a comfort," said the young girl, coming closer. "I was working on my plans. Plans I never told the rest of you. The Golden Ark was the key, not only to free us, but to rescue the others. Brian, Elizabeth, Aiken, Stein, to free all of the human slaves, don't you see? I really could have done it. With the golden torque, I could have tamed this thing inside me and used it."
Amory heard herself babbling.
"We're all grateful to you, Felice. Believe me, we were simply too stunned by it all to say anything after the fight. And Dougal, he was just too fast for Basil and Yosh to stop, and too crazy to realize what he was doing when he threw the torque away. He probably believed he wouldn't be safe from Apone's power until the torque was separated from her body."
Felice said nothing. After a while, the nun said, "Perhaps you could get another." There was a sigh.
"They know about me now, so it will be very dangerous, but I'll have to try. Maybe waylay another caravan or even go to Fenaya. It'll be hard, and I'll need help."
"We'll help?" Felice laughed softly.
"I'll help. I won't be retiring to any hermitage for quite some time yet." "Ah, that's good. I need your help, Amory. I need you."
"Felice, don't misunderstand."
"Oh, I know all about your little vow of renunciation. But that was made 6 million years ago in a different world.
Now I think you need me as much as I need you.
I need your protection. We all do.
You need more than that.
Amory backed away, tripped over a rock, and fell, tearing open the scabbed cuts on her hands.
Let me help you up, said Felice.
But the nun scrambled to her feet, unaided, and turned back toward the glowing remnants of the campfire, where the others were sleeping. She stumbled and clenched her fingers into the lacerated palms so that her nails opened the cut even more, while behind her, Felice laughed in the darkness. 16.
He's ready, Suki. You must take the final discharge.
But can I? I could botch it again, Elizabeth.
You won't. You'll be able to handle this aspect of his healing. He wouldn't let me, but you can do it.
Don't be afraid. All right. Just let him come out of the Torque's neural bath slowly. I'm ready.
Illinois cornfields, flat as a table and stretching from horizon to horizon, with the toy farmhouse and outbuildings lonely amid the immensity. Sitting in one of the cornrows, a three-year-old boy and an Alsatian bitch. The boy, clever with his hands and mischievous, circumvents a childproof fastener and removes a beeper trace from his jeans. He offers it to the bitch. She is pregnant and of capricious appetite, and so she swallows it. The boy rises from the ground and toddles off down the road toward an interesting noise in the far distance. The bitch, unsatisfied by her electronic snack, runs toward the farmhouse where lunch is being prepared.
No, I can't go there again.
Hush, easy. You're close, so close. A robot harvester, nearly as large as the farmhouse and bright orange, moves along, swallowing the corn plants in a 30-row swath, grinding the stalks and leaves to useful pulp, shelling the ears, long as a man's forearm, and packing the rich golden kernels into containers for shipment to other farms all over the galactic milieu. This new maize hybrid will yield 20 cubic meters of grain to the hectare.